And the weather today, a high of 25 degrees centigrade, lows of 16 degrees centigrade. And after that murky start, it'll turn sunny and we'll metamorphose into another lovely warm day with just the possibility of some thundery showers.
Hi-dee-ho, neighbours. This is actress, producer, Los Angeles Breakfast Club board chair, and Fuzz Aldrin enthusiast, Lily Holloman. I have been a proud member of the expanded Alex Lefchick Midweek Drivette team for years. Congratulations to you, dear listener, on having found this oasis of podcast audio magic in the cosmos.
Over the last few years, what used to be a vacation has become a staycation. Now it would seem that the fearcation is entering into our vocabulary, as over almost half of British folks say that reading online reviews make them stress about their holidays and what it's going to be like in reality. To hopefully suss out the difference between real space, flesh space and virtual space, we're delighted to be able to welcome a psychologist. I like to use the term Renaissance man in many ways, the legendary Dr. David Lewis. How are you, David?
Oh, very kind. Thank you so much. Yes, it's curious, isn't it? I seem to remember that in the forces they used to tell you that knowledge conquers fear. Mm. But it seems that these days, the more you know about where you're going on holiday, thanks to the ubiquitous nature of the online world, the more terrified people become. In fact, about 4 out of 10 people say they actually start to worry about their holiday the moment they've booked it.
Which kind of is not really in keeping with the whole essence of what a holiday should
be
about, really.
Absolutely. There seems to be so many things people can worry about now. I mean, there's obviously political instability and terrorism looming its ugly head. And around about 3/4 of people, 75%, said that was uppermost in their mind when they were booking a holiday destination, which seems reasonable enough. A big worry was, is it going to be all kind of end in tears? Because around about half the people we talked to said that they were very worried about being disappointed by the place they went to, not living up to expectations, by the being food poisoned and stuff like that. So it's kind of the fear of the unknown, a fear of being let down, having spent quite a lot of money, and maybe through the dark days of winters, worrying about worrying about whether he's going to be up to the mark, and then being let down. It just seems a heavy blow for a lot of people, perhaps reasonably.
I often use the line with students that fear is just an acronym for false expectations appearing real.
Yeah.
And in terms of that whole notion of beginning to sort of be concerned, I was surprised to find that young people are also ones who actually find that online sites are stressing them out, because I would have thought it would have been the reverse.
Yes, I agree with you. You would have thought that being sort of the digital natives, people who have grown up in the computer world, and people like me who are very much digital immigrants, who, you know, the world of computing wasn't around when I was growing up, you thought they'd be very comfortable with it. But again, I think it's probably because a lot of things kind of worry young people, and maybe this is just another of it. And maybe because they actually understand the digital world rather better, they know how distrustful one needs to be of a lot of sites. You get a lot of information which is just really disinformation or downright lies. So again, I think it's two things. One is the amount of information which is available, which can lead to kind of the idea of paralysis of analysis. You know, if you've got 50 things to choose from, it's a lot harder than if you've just got two, obviously, and that can lead to stress and anxiety. And I think the other thing is knowing how trustworthy the site is. Can you actually depend on it? You know, you go to a villa site, let's say, and you see this beautiful villa surrounded by what appears to be, you know, wonderful countryside. And actually, when you arrive there, you find out there's an abattoir or a Destruction Derby Stadium right behind you or right beside you, which was actually helpfully cut out of the photographs. So I think this is some sites, Villa Plus for example, are having now 360 degree photographs, so you can actually stand there and swing the camera all round, so you can actually see what is in the neighbourhood. And I think that's a very, very useful idea.
I think it was the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon who once stated that 90% of everything is garbage. He actually was more colourful than garbage, but
Yes.
If we're looking towards that, I mean, one would have thought actually it's only a matter of decades before we actually have virtual vacations as well and simply don't move from our armchair and simply sort of just go around and use the computer to sort of guide our way through.
Sort of lie on a sunbed and put visual glasses on and we're on some tropical beach.
Yes, I can't say I necessarily would look forward to that, but might solve this problem slightly.
Well, it might be a little bit cheaper. But no, I think holidays are a good thing. I mean, all the research, there was actually some interesting research, I think, out from Harvard a few weeks back showing that holidays actually can be a very beneficial to you. They give you space. They put you in a different world. They put you in what we clinical psychologists would call a therapeutic island in a way. And a therapeutic island is where, you know, you're sobbing your heart out in a therapy group. But you know you don't have to meet any of the people in the therapy group again. And so you can use them a bit like a tissue, use it and lose it. And I think a lot of holidays are a bit like that. They just step back and take a perspective on your life, perhaps to enjoy better weather than you've enjoyed during the winter, which in England wouldn't be too difficult, would it? And actually to look at things from a different perspective. So I do think they are a good idea, but I think they are increasing these days because of travel problems and worries about terrorism and political instability. Plus the falling pound are fraught with problems.
Well, I do like your term paralysis analysis, which I think is a modern update on the old Buddhist phrase, where there is choice, there is misery.
That's right.
Another perspective. In terms of making a holiday less stressful, we mentioned obviously villaplus.com. Yep. Is there any kind of magic formula other than breathing, remembering to breathe?
Well, breathing is a good idea. I think.
Indeed.
But actually, it's a completely different topic we're just not talking about. But there, it's breathing. I've done a lot of research in breathing, and breathing is very interesting. And most people do what we call upside down breathing because they're actually breathing using their rib cage rather than their diaphragm. So we can talk about that maybe at a later date.
I would have thought so. We'll have that in the sort of narrative tropes to be followed up at a later date from that perspective.
It's very important. But yes, I suppose from a kind of a practical viewpoint, always obviously go to a travel agent who's a member of ABTA. That gives you a guarantee that if anything does go pear-shaped, you're going to get your money back. And maybe who's been a member of ABTA, not just from last week, but maybe for several years. So they've got a good track record. I think that's important. I personally, if I'm going to hire a villa somewhere, I like to have a representative actually on site, maybe a native speaker, somebody who really knows the bureaucracy and the language of the place, so they can sort out problems as and when they arise, not rather than having to phone London or Glasgow or Edinburgh or wherever, or Manchester, and get somebody to try and do it via Skype or the internet. I think that's not very sensible. I'd like to have somebody I can talk to.
Good preparation always pays dividends.
And give yourself time. You know, men are particularly very impulsive in their purchases. I often think they tend to be a bit like an SAS hit squad going in to rescue a hostage. They kind of
it's
rush
the hunter gatherer in us. We can't help
they're using
it.
The hunter bit. They're rushing exactly. in, buying the first thing they see and rushing out again. And women, again, as this survey showed, 46% of women do take a completely different view. They step back, they comparison shop, they look at different prices, they look at what you're actually getting. And so when they do make a decision, they tend to make a much better decision than men. They're slower very often, but they are much more competent at doing it. So maybe let your partner book the holiday. But then again, I think it's all down to removing the pressure by giving yourself plenty of time to think about it. Round about 40% of people now are booking 6 months in advance, which is kind of why we're talking about holidays now. When people say, why? Holidays? They're over. We're now looking forward to Christmas. Yeah, but the more
winter
time,
vacations, they can also come into play as well.
Absolutely.
Same criteria.
A lot of people, particularly my friends who live in Scotland, when the weather tends to get a little bit worse than it does south, they're heading for the sun. And that's a great idea, I think. The crowds will be less. You'll get a lovely place with fewer people around.
And less stress. Hopefully. Having said that, it has to be noted that somehow our most positive memories can be those that have been the most stressful at the time. So who knows? There's always a sort of different take on the whole thing. It's all down to perspective, perhaps.
And when you get a really horrible holiday, at least you can tweet it.
There we are. David, as ever, it's been a delight, almost unparalleled. But we've got those two standard questions, which we always conclude with. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It's been absolutely wonderful, darling.
So can we hopefully prevail upon your good self to join us again in the Dr. Distant Future?
Let's talk about breathing.
I think we should. It's absolutely essential. Dr. David Lewis, many thanks indeed.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Especially upside down breathing, which I know that combined with watching Ben Hearn suffering from paralysis analysis and planning his next trip to Rome, etc. It's just one of the many talented things that Richard
this
Fitzwilliams is involved with. Isn't that right, Richard?
Upside down breathing, I think not. Include me out.
Oh, you might be doing it unconsciously even as we speak.
No, I'm on looking at my notes even as we speak.
Oh, about
Bridget Jones's baby.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought the occasion would also lead to both Bridget Jones, Blair Witch, etc. But I mean, before then, just a final sort of 17 reviews for Ben Hur in online, print, TV, For Your Good Self, and so on. Astounding. So clearly, it's well ahead in terms of the Richard Fitzwilliams review stakes, even if it isn't a number one movie to actually go see and book out for all the family to visit.
Well, I'm afraid it's behind Exodus, Gods and Kings, which was 32, and Saving Private Ryan, which was 24.
Well, let's move on to Bridget, because again, I have to say, I've seen the first one. I think I might have seen the second one as well, but I've can't. Helen Fielding.
One that you'd forget, I think.
Well, yeah.
First one was very good fun. The second one, well, rather disastrous. I mean, I thought that this played to its audience. It's formulaic. You know who you are. The politically correct won't go and see it. It's about, obviously, Helen Fielding's creation, an overweight Chardonnay-quaffing singleton with a huge inferiority complex, a shambolic gait I'm most amused by Renée Zellweger's walk, I have to say, committing her woes to a diary, dreaming of the perfect romance. And this, we meet her at the first scene, on the occasion of her 43rd birthday. She's lonely, she's bemoaning her fate, and what does she do? She attends the funeral of Daniel Cleaver. You will recall he was the love rat played by Hugh Grant, and very well, I have to say, whom she had a fling with, a deceitful former lover. And then she runs into Mark Darcy, played, of course, by Colin Firth, who's there with his wife, and, of course, who she's had this fling with. They are obviously meant to be together, but will they be? And what actually happens? She works as a news producer at Hard News. A friend of hers takes her to a rock festival, and by accident she wanders into the wrong tent, of course. She meets the wealthy and amiable Jack Quant, played by Patrick Dempsey. They sleep together. Then subsequently she discovers Mark is divorcing. They reunite briefly. And then she discovers she's pregnant. And since she has no clue as to which either Jack or...
It's a baby. It's in the title, Richard. It's called Bridget Jones' Baby,
yes,
for goodness sakes.
The father, that's the point.
Do we care, Richard? Do we care?
Well, the thing is, the answer I actually would say is that we do, because these questions, you know, who the father is, how does she tell the two men who might be and whose it actually turns out to be, they add a frisson to the fun. This is fun. It's for those who find the particular character, which obviously you don't, and I accept a lot of people don't, diverting, amusing, hilarious, or whatever. And the good news is it is directed by Sharon Maguire, who made the first Bridget Jones's Diary, which I did like, and Renée Zellweger does her stuff extremely well. I mean,
but isn't it subject to the law of diminishing returns? I mean, surely it's a case of, oh, please. I mean, there are certain franchise movies, tentpole scenarios that can sustain that. But
I mean, it's been created, so to speak, where you have cliched characters who play on the English rituals and locations. Much of the satire is pretty feeble. There are some dire moments. But there is the hilarious aspect of, Renée Zellweger, she's extremely good in the part, and I was amused. If you see this in a particular state of mind, you will find some of it quite touching and some of it hilarious. And I mean, the satire isn't that which you would consider subtle, God forbid. But
is it biting?
Very good fun.
Oh, well, it's a sort of maybe. Interested to see if any of the midweek drivers sort of will go for that. Never mind. Last night, as is our wont, we occasionally trailer hedge to what we're going to speak about with your good self, Richard. And I have to say, Sam Stone, ace author and, of course, midweek driver, host of the Stone Tapes, and myself were in complete agreement when we maintained that the first Blair Witch movie was probably the worst waste of cinematic time we have ever experienced in any way, shape or form. I would indeed pour as much scorn on the first Blair Witch movie publicly as you have done upon Ben-Hur and indeed arguably the acting career of Chris Hemsworth. Anyway, carry on.
Well, I would say I haven't seen the first Blair Witch movie or indeed...
It's an exercise in zero budget, excellently marketed horror.
Of course it is, and it doesn't take much to scare me, but this is the third and it's called Blair Witch. And students, four of them no less, plus two local residents, venture into the Black Hills to find a missing sister, one of them. And what do they find? There are woods there. It's filmed in with handheld cameras. Everything.
Not handheld cameras again, for goodness sakes.
All filmed with... It all
wasn't
filmed
it enough for J.J. Abrahams and Cloverfield?
And that's why if we go to sleep, we'll wake up and we'll find something rather unpleasant around us. Of course, it's gimmickry, and I would agree with the line you take. But there's no doubt that if you're squeamish like me, you haven't seen this type of movie before, it is clever of its sort. Mm. I mean, there is absolutely no doubt who pops up where.
Yeah.
Shadow can be spotted for a scintilla of a second.
You see, perhaps what...
With music that will make you...
What we perhaps need is Bridget Jones's Blair Witch Baby. Then I'd go and see it.
Oh, yeah. My goodness, you're ambitious with that.
That's the pitch. That's the high-level piece. Bridget Jones, Blair Witch Baby.
I avoid this because if you didn't like the first one, you most certainly won't like this. I dare say I didn't see it. It is disorientating. It is scary. I think it was pretty terrifying, but I did get used to it because, there's, again, I mentioned, obviously, the formula of Bridget Jones's Diary. There's no doubt there's a formula here. But if someone's foot gets a... cut on it. Well, what happens? I mean, what occurs on trees which you didn't...
Yeah, I'm well...
Etc., etc. And what if you go into any form of shack or home and the cameras move around the different parts of it and you see or you think you see or did you see and the music will suddenly...
Does it telegraph to us the music? Does the music also telegraph the plot, rather like a badly written American soundtrack?
Yes, about it. Eduardo Sanchez and Daniel Myrick should be in your sights.
Yeah, I think Phil Leonis's comment was it's getting some good reviews. I wasn't quite sure where Phil was standing on Blair Witch, although perhaps he should stand anywhere on Blair Witch.
Well, it's unusual. I mean, obviously, the budget's diminutive. Obviously, the mind plays all sorts of tricks. You know the angle that it takes.
Well, yes, but Hitchcock also used to use the power of the mind and did it much more effectively. Anyway, that's fine.
I did not see Hell or High Water. I wondered if I'd have a chance to get in a mention of this contemporary tale in Texas, which actually is very elegiac because it's a homage to movies like Giant, where oil can be discovered on your property, and also to the outlaw, the cult of the outlaw, which you would think would be outmoded today. And yet,
no, not with Donald Trump and Hillary running for the presidency.
Well, I mean, as an elegiac western, two brothers execute a series of robberies in small Texas towns in order to save their mother's home and pass it on, otherwise the banks will foreclose. It's the wicked banks, you see, not that, as opposed to the army who cleared the Native Americans off their lands. Subsequently, settlers moved in, but now it's the banks who are controlling it. Chris Pine as Toby Howard and Ben Foster as his somewhat psychopathic brother Tanner. The problem between them, I have to say, to learn, and it's pivotal to the story about their personal relations and their family. It's almost impossible to hear a word they say. I do have to...
Richard, it's Captain James T. Kirk in the J.J. Abrahams universe and the upcoming Steve Trevor in the DC Comics incarnation of Wonder Woman. Of course, Chris Pine is okay.
You speak with an accent which can be very, very inaudible. But nonetheless, the facts are that all has been discovered on this farm and they... pull off this audacious, indeed it's extremely audacious, you turn up a small town, you rob the bank, and gradually you accumulate enough to pay off, except that they're being pursued by two rangers, Marcus Hamilton, a real turn, splendid Jeff Bridges, really, really, absolutely outrageous character. He has a close relationship with Alberto Parker, who's a Native American played by Jill Birmingham, and I have to say that some of the racist comments that he makes, but they're made in jest, are outrageous. But the point is, the Rangers have to discover, they have to anticipate where these robbers are going to strike. And it's a clever plot. It's visually absolutely mesmerizing, where you see a herd of cattle fleeing from a bushfire. This is the image that sticks in my mind. This and the bistas, the vastness of it, sprawling, as I say, by going back to George Stevens' 1955 Giant with Elizabeth Taylor. And there's the Robin Hood aspect of it, because these banks are robbing everyone, so why shouldn't they be robbed? But even when there are fatalities, what happens subsequently, it's a clever plot, it's well done, and visually it is amazing, and Jeff Bridges certainly. He's an amazing actor, and he's excellently cast here, but it is far, far too often inaudible.
But in terms of levels of inaudibility, how does it compare with the incarnation of Bane in Christopher Nolan's Batman? I mean, that was, I maintain, the Richard Fitzwilliam's...
Well, nothing has been as bad as that.
Well, and there we are, then.
I go back to Miami Vice.
I
couldn't understand a word.
Well, hopefully when Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children opens, you'll be able to actually comment on Eva Green's wonderful articulation and diction and so on. Meanwhile...
Eva Green often plays a mad woman.
Does she play any other kind? Even in Casino Royale, Vespa Lynd was...
She was also a Persian admiral in 300, a rise...
Yes, exactly.
Absolute rubbish.
Oh, come now. Not compared to Blair Witch, but let's, you know, that's...
300 itself was excellent. Oh, yeah. Did you see 300, Rise of an Empire?
I've seen them both. What a wonderful sort of... Lots of pectoral muscles and other...
One was marvellous, because I must remind you that commemorate 100
Sparta,
years...
Sparta.
Since D.W. Griffith's Intolerance, I gave a talk at Westminster Library a week ago on the epic movie and how it had developed up with its ups and downs. The 300 itself was a glorious piece of invention by Jack Snyder, based, you will remember, on the 300 Spartans with Ralph Richardson.
Exactly.
Richard Egan.
Well put together and based indeed on the original comic book series of the same name, a graphic narrative rather, that was put together. Richard, I've got to say, as you head off to Rome, don't forget to check out the locations as featured in the Guy Ritchie Man from U.N.C.L.E. and pay homage to the ways in which obviously Napoleon Solo is played by Henry Cavill, and indeed Ilya Kuryakin as played by another fine solo who's eluded me at present, but I will track it down, and indeed of course the wonderful Alicia Vikander, who was also starring within that whole sort of sequence. So
I've been an admirer of Alicia Vikander for a long time, since The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but
yeah.
I do believe her talents could have been displayed to better advantage.
I'm outraged, Richard. Once again, you know, I think... Anyway, the bottom line is, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It's been super.
And I take it you'll be back post-Rome. Arrivederci. Giorno. In about a week's time?
Yes, I shall just be back.
Ciao, bene, Signor Fitzwilliams. Farewell. Good community spirit. neighbours. All you need is neighbours. Do you know your neighbours? Well, a recent survey has discovered we don't really know our actual neighbours, as we tend to lean more towards social media to gain a sense of community. Now, to address this and develop a whole range of other aspects with relation to this, including a sensational new app that's just being launched, we're delighted to be able to welcome Director of the Integration Hub, David Goodhart. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
And the creator, because indeed that's the best way to actually refer to the creator of the app that will hopefully sort of work in so many ways to actually help with this process, Nick Lisher. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
David, if we can come to you first, this recent survey that suggests that actually we live in a world where, although technically, you know, we hearken back to a time where we were all good friends with neighbours, etc., actually we don't. Busy lives, shyness, a reliance on technology, many people don't actually know who's living in their neighbourhood.
Yes, I think that is true. Communities have become somewhat looser over recent decades. I mean, this is a very long-term process, though. I mean, we tend to live more mobile lives. Many of us are a lot more affluent. We're more individualistic. Families are looser. Women now invariably go out to work, whereas perhaps back in the 50s and 60s, they were at the centre of neighbourhoods and communities during the daytime. And so all of these things have happened. I mean, there are some aspects of that to be mourned, and there are some aspects to be celebrated. It's just sort of the way of the modern world.
In the 21st century, is it a case of looking at, as you mentioned, the modern world? We're looking at sort of developing that. So when we come to something like this wonderful app Nextdoor, it's a way of actually sort of, you know, engaging with our community needs, because we are still human beings. We still have that need. I mean, Nick, just talk us through the process that kind of led you to come up with Nextdoor.
Well, I'm British and I'm quite shy. So the idea of going and knocking on my neighbour's front door to meet them...
Not even for a cup of sugar?
Yeah, it's reasonably alien to me. Yet when I launched my neighbourhood about 6 or 8 weeks ago as part of our beta launch, I was pleasantly surprised, because within 6 to 8 weeks, 160 people had signed up. And I had had real-life conversations with 15 or 20 of my neighbours. And beforehand, I only knew a couple by first name. And we're seeing all over the country, in the 250 neighbourhoods that have launched on Nextdoor so far, that people are coming together to do things like swap garden vegetables, to find lost pets, and to share safety tips.
David, in terms of that, I mean, that can only be a good thing. Do you feel it's a way of actually using virtual space to get in touch with the real world?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's sort of the lovely thing about this, in a way. People talk about how the kind of new social media and the digital world have sort of separated us from our immediate physical communities and created these personal diasporas, which may involve people in other countries and all, you know, people a long way away. But the good thing about this is that it's using this modern technology, which often does do that, to bring people back together who actually do physically live very close to each other. So, if it works, I think it'd be a very good thing. I mean, I think there is this issue of whether it's likely to work most effectively in the places that, in a sense, need it least, where you have lots of very well-connected, young, affluent people who are used to downloading apps and so on, and the places where people are more separate and suspicious of each other, perhaps the poorer, rougher neighbourhoods, may not take it up so much. Although I think the experience in America suggests that isn't necessarily true.
From your own perspective, Nick, what inspired you to come up with this? I mean, it seems a sort of almost a blindingly obvious sort of application in many ways, but was it a case of you looking at rural communities? Was it urban communities? Was it town-based communities? Was it migrant communities? Was it indeed a variation on Skype across international communities?
I think it's relevant for all of those communities, because everyone lives in a neighbourhood and everyone wants to feel more connected to their neighbourhood. That's what we feel. And I think that a lot of people have this notion, this idea, that technology, the use of smartphones, is making us less connected with the real world and less connected with people around us. And we saw that social media could have this wonderful force for good in terms of connecting with the people around us. I'll give you a small example. In Gorringe Park in South London, some people set up a Nextdoor neighbourhood, and they organised the first street party that they'd had in the area for nearly 40 years, since the Queen's Silver Jubilee. And we think that's a wonderful example of the power of connectivity within a local neighbourhood leading to people coming together and meeting face to face.
Sounds absolutely perfect. David, if I can play devil's advocate for a moment, what about the net curtain twitching syndrome, which is often sort of accused at certain sort of aspects of the British character, where in essence we become nosy neighbours and you don't necessarily want to have everything going online, or indeed cyberbullying?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, one of the sort of good things about the developments of the last few decades is that we are freer. We tend to be more individualistic. We tend to be more liberal in many ways, less judgmental, and you know, we've deliberately chosen to escape some of the more oppressive aspects of very tightly knit communities of the past. But I think there's an element of having we can have the best of both worlds now in some ways. I mean, that, you know, we've made that great leap over the last two or three generations into a kind of freer, more liberal, more individualistic world. But we miss some of the aspects of the old world, and through things like this Nextdoor app, it may be that we can to some extent have the best of both worlds.
I was fascinated to find that in the survey, less than half, 41%, would currently feel comfortable knocking next door to borrow a cup of sugar. It used to be a standard northern thing, surely. Only 38% would be happy to give a next door neighbour a spare key. I suppose on a slightly different note, I've found from a personal perspective that even when it comes to packages being delivered from online services, I sometimes feel guilty if it's left with a neighbour. I much prefer to actually go to a collecting point. I mean, is this something else, Nick, where, you know, this kind of app could actually sort of, you know, provide sort of some sort of community sense of where people can help each other?
This is exactly what we're here to do. And you mentioned a great example, which is simply having a package delivered. And I think this happened to me the other morning, in that one of my neighbours was having a garden clear out, and she had run out of space in her brown bin. So she quite simply put a message on Nextdoor to say, does anyone have any spare space? A really, really simple example of neighbours helping each other. But in doing that, we met. And because of that, now when we need help with something else, we know each other face to face, and we know each other by name, and we'll feel comfortable sharing those kind of moments.
So, Nick, how can people access this particular app, Nextdoor? Is it simply because you go online and sort the thing through? What's the best place to actually go to find out details and indeed talk with the community about maybe installing it into their environments?
Sure thing. We go live across the United Kingdom today. You can go to nextdoor.co.uk. Enter your postcode and your email address and sign up. Or indeed, you can download the app from the Apple Store or the Google Play Store on Android and sign up as well.
And David, will you be signing up, or is it a case of, no, I might be director of the Integration Hub, but that's a step too far?
In fact, I tried to sign up last night, but I misremembered my password, so I failed.
So eager. There was a sort of password scenario from that perspective. So as we sort of progress with respect to the app, will you be looking at getting more bells and whistles? Because that's the other side of things, that things never stand still. It seems that just as you sort one app out, it sort of develops, it becomes more sophisticated and so on. There are upgrades that are required from the whole thing. Is there a kind of a whole strategy that you've laid out in terms of this, Nick, in terms of upgrades over the forthcoming years and decades?
Absolutely. So for us, you know, we're all about using the power of technology to create stronger, safer neighbourhoods. And that starts with the neighbourhoods themselves. So our focus for the short term is to make sure as many neighbourhoods start using Nextdoor as possible. But then what we've seen in terms of the way people use it in the United States is that we start integrating with public services. So if councils want to start communicating with their neighbours, they can do so. We then move on to local businesses. A lot of local businesses near me are wanting to use Nextdoor to promote their services as well.
And just finally, again, playing sort of devil's advocate quite explicitly here, in terms of the cyber snooper concern, is there a sort of backup system that's in place there? Because, you know, ultimately we've talked about the really great bits of this application that can actually help, but there are concerns about individual privacy, etc. Are safeguards in place?
That's a great question. So to join Nextdoor, you have to verify your address. And we do that simply by sending you a postcard or by verifying your home phone number. The communities are small and contained. We like our neighborhoods to be between a couple of hundred and a couple of thousand households. And so you know you're talking only to your direct neighbors. Now, if in the very, very rare instance there is some activity that people aren't keen on, some neighbors will simply mute that person. And so it is self-moderated in that way.
Superb look at the whole sort of sequence that's around from that perspective. It's been wonderful just sharing some thoughts with your good self. David Goodhart, director of the Integration Hub and creator and founder of the fabulous Nextdoor application. Nick Lisher, many thanks indeed. And hopefully we'll speak again soon in real space, cyberspace, or any other sort of spatial connotations we can think about. Many thanks, gentlemen. Yes, of course, the thing is, ultimately, when you're talking about Nextdoor, the private social network for your neighbourhood, what will our ace writer and general Tyneside guru extraordinaire Arthur McKenzie make of this scenario for the 21st century? Good morning, Arthur. How are you?
I'm charming. It's very interesting. Unfortunately, I'm not a technophobe at all. I've got a mobile phone which is about 25 years old.
Nice.
Yeah. I have no apps. I don't know what an app is.
Exactly.
All I know is that people just don't speak to each other anyhow. And one of the causes is all this traffic on the roads and the people parking in the street and taking other people's space. I think that the most important thing is that when you're out in the street and you see your neighbours, all you got to do is say hello. It's as simple as that. You don't need a mobile phone.
Well, you see, you could have actually put your finger on the pulse of a drastically radical aspect there, which we'll be taking up in the second hour of the programme with ace psychologist Dr. Becky Spellman. But yeah, Nextdoor, the best way to stay in the know about what's going on in your neighbourhood, whether it's finding a last-minute babysitter, learning about an upcoming block party, or hearing about a rash of car break-ins. There is a kind of tendency for us to look back nostalgically into the past, and particularly in the north, you know, whether it's Lincoln or Newcastle, and so say, back in the day we could go into so-and-so. Was that the case, Arthur? Because clearly you were in the police force, you were detective chief inspector, you worked through that. Did you sort of sense that things have changed in terms of the ways in which neighbourhoods operate, or have we always been a kind of composite range of people, some of whom are quite social and outgoing, and others who say, just keep away?
I think it varies from area to area. There's always a key person in an area who will try and get people together, always. I think that I can remember the days when we didn't have telephones, that if you went to knock on somebody's door and they weren't in, if you want to leave them a message, all you had to do was put your hand through the letterbox, pull a bit of string and pull a key out and go into the house, they used to leave the key for you.
Yeah. That's likely to
happen. So that, from that position to the current position, where when you go out, even if you just go at the shops, you double lock your door. Because opportunity thieves are now, they do roam the streets, I can tell you now, as a former cop. They're looking for opportunity all the time. If you have a tracker, a GPS in your car, these old ones that you used to put on the shelf, if you left your car open, it would be gone in 10 minutes if you'd just gone around the corner.
Sad reflection on some of the 21st century challenges we're actually faced with. But let's move on to more positive news. Ian, of course, is sorting out a variety of other bits and pieces in betwixt times, Ian Lennox, because I suspect he would have, you could hardly have got him down from the ceiling after Queen's Park Rangers 0, Newcastle United 6.
Yeah, absolutely.
just continue it. Win, 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 win. I mean, apart from losing the first two games, it looks as though Rafa Benitez, no real challenges at all, really.
Oh, I think he's the right man in the job, but I don't think it's all over yet. I think he's got a few struggles ahead. I mean, you only need a couple of bad injuries and you're looking for a little bit of help. Yeah. I think he's the right man, though. He's got the right attitude. He's managed to get rid of the guys that weren't interested.
Well, he seems to have certainly sorted out. Now, in terms of news that broke this week, which I must admit I think is more noticeable for what they haven't included, the lacunae, the gap that's actually in there. Yes, it's all well and good to say that a statue to properly recognise the career of Newcastle United legend Alan Shearer has been unveiled outside St James's Park with hair. Nice. But where's the Arthur McKenzie statue?
Well, I know when I was in my head on the job, I remember going into this very rough pub in Newcastle. I was actually, we started to check the pubs at night and sort of see what faces were in there. And they were all laughing when I went in there. And when I went through the back room, I had a photograph of me on the dartboard and they were playing darts.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got Terry McDermott, you've got Kevin Keegan, you've got Alan Shearer there, Lord Mayor of Newcastle, Hazel Stevenson unveiled the statue. You've got the one hand in the air goal celebration. Not only do these statues actually go up when people have actually passed away, but I think obviously since Sir Alex Ferguson, I think, had one, it seems that the vogue now is to actually put up the statue whilst they're still there. Well, I mean, I still think I saw a joint Ian Lennox, Arthur McKenzie duo statue. You could sort of be recreating scenes from The Brothers. Could well.
Yeah.
I'll put it out there.
With our hands around each other's throat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all positive stuff. That's the important thing. Arthur, it's time to actually ask you to be a musical critic one more time.
Okay.
Because we have Marcus Lindsay, who were the choice of Cameron Tilbury from Nashville last night. Camo, not feeling too well, actually, because he had a slip disc. So he did the phone link whilst kind of in some considerable pain. So I think over in Nashville now, it's just coming around to about 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning. In Lincoln, England, of course, it's just coming around to 12 minutes to 9 o'clock. But this is Marcus Lindsay awaiting the Arthur McKenzie view on his little country number, One Less Fool in Amarillo.
Crystal clear, so you read between the lines. The heart only hears what the heart wants to hear, and hope keeps the love hanging on. Your friends can't tell you what you don't.